Afternoon. Thank you, Steve. I guess it looks like the webcast is working. Yeah. Hello, Cinda. Last Monday, Trumpets, we were sitting in a hospital room watching the webcast. She was discharged. Cinda, my wife, was discharged Monday, and she's recovering nicely from her surgery. And we are putting off finding the cause of this problem until after the feast. I think it might be coming from the adrenals or the kidneys, but we're not sure. But right now she's feeling great, and I'm sure she's watching. Hey. Thank you very much for your prayers and expressions of concern. Deeply appreciate it. And she'll probably need some more. If you wouldn't mind, please. In the first century, there was a religious philosophy, a school of thought, I think, that you could get to know God, and not just know about him, maybe not just know his name or some secrets about him, but actually know God personally, you know, experience him, know him like someone you knew, know personally. Very attractive idea. But I think it is the other gospel that was the opposing gospel in the letters of Paul in the New Testament. I say it's an enticing idea. Which of us ourselves wouldn't like to meet God personally, to talk to him personally? But this kind of knowing is expressed in that philosophy with the Greek word gnosis. So that's what they mean when they talk about knowledge or gnosis. And that's why this philosophy became known as knowing God, or Gnosticism. And as I said, I think this is the other gospel that Paul fought throughout the New Testament. It made inroads into the church in the first half of the century, first century, and I started arguing that this was the identity of that opposition about 2 years ago, with a series of messages in chronological order, taking the books of the New Testament, which the first ones are Paul. So we started with Paul. We'll still have some ways to go in Paul. This is the 13th, if you've been counting, in that series. I'm going to address the last prison epistle today, Hebrews. You may question my premise right away there. First of all, that Paul was even the author of Hebrews. And second of all, was it prison epistles? You know, you can turn to a few reference works on the web or in a library that will apply the epistle to the Hebrews to the problems that Paul was facing in the churches of Asia Minor and of Greece. They just don't apply it in that direction. Nor do they see it as an anti-Gnostic gospel. So I'm going to spend a few minutes on those subjects of who wrote it and to whom. That needs to be addressed before you could even possibly accept my thesis about why he wrote it. But I'm convinced that Hebrews is indeed a prison epistle. And it's written at the same time as the other prison epistles, from the same place, and because of the same issues that were happening in Paul's churches. That is, that Hebrews was written to the Jewish Christians of Asia Minor and Greece because they were being misled by false teachers. And we see three primary topics that need clarification and are clarified in the letter to the Hebrews. And they are angels, Melchizedek, and the tabernacle. And that's my title today, Hebrews. Angels, Melchizedek, and the tabernacle. They're all themes of the Gnostic heresy. They are not themes of Judaism. They are themes of Gnosticism. Okay, first of all, is it Paul's epistle at all? Number one, who wrote it? Who's it by? You turn to reference works and they'll speculate about who wrote it, because they don't really know. But one thing they will declare, and they know for sure, is that Paul didn't. Here's a quote from Wikipedia, which is the final authority. In general, the evidence against Pauline authorship is considered too solid for scholarly dispute. Now, I totally disagree, but I guess I'm no scholar. And I think I'm preaching to the choir about this today because I think most of you believe that Paul wrote the epistle to the Hebrews, so I don't think I have to be too convincing here. But I'm just saying you don't have to be timid about believing that Paul wrote the letter to the Hebrews, because there are plenty of reasons to believe it. First of all, there are the historical witnesses. The eyewitnesses at the time, you know, those to whom he wrote it. The churches of Asia Minor and Greece never doubted that Hebrews was written by Paul. They never doubted. Those who knew Paul personally, consider Timothy, consider Tychicus, consider Luke. They were still in the churches after this time, after Paul's execution later in the 60s. They never cast any doubt on the church's understanding that Paul wrote the epistle to the Hebrews. Those who were there knew that he wrote it. Secondly, there's a lot of internal evidence that fit, that the words of Hebrews fit Paul and no one else. I guess I have 3 points here. A, he writes from Italy. At the end of the book, at the end of the letter, Hebrews 13. I'll spend most of the time in Hebrews today, obviously. 13:23. Know you that our brother Timothy is set at liberty, with whom, if he come shortly, I will see you. And the next verse, salute them that have the rule over you and all the saints. They of Italy salute you. Now, who would write from Italy? And who would be expected to return to the church with Timothy, their brother? No one else but Paul. Paul's use of scriptures, his use of arguments, his use of expressions throughout the book are very close to his other letters. There are so many, I just don't have time to go through a comparison, but you can go to a lot of conservative commentaries and find those comparisons. The only real argument that Paul is not the author of Hebrews is based solely on language. Hebrews, they will claim, is written in a Greek style and a vocabulary that is too good to be Paul's. Paul couldn't have written that good Greek. It is written in a high, almost poetic Greek, not the common Koine Greek spoken in the Roman Empire, but the Greek used by Hellenistic philosophers, Jewish philosophers, like Philo of Alexandria. And I, of course, am no Greek scholar myself. I couldn't identify the difference between classical Greek and Koine Greek. But I am completely sure that Paul could. Paul could. Paul was born and raised where? Tarsus. Greek was his native language. Not only that, Tarsus was no academic backwater. Tarsus had its own Platonic academy. It was the school of philosophy, probably second or third only to Alexandria and Athens itself. According to BiblePlaces.com, quote, Tarsus grew into a cultural and intellectual center. Stoic philosophers like Athenodorus, Zeno, Antipater, and Nestor lived in the city in the first century A.D. A city of great importance as a learning center of the ancient world alongside Alexandria and Athens. Thus, Paul was more than capable of writing in a classical Greek academic style when the occasion arose for it, when it was called for. And as we will see as we go on here, there is a good reason why he would adopt this style in this letter. But as I said, most of you are probably already believe that Paul wrote Hebrews, so I won't spend any more time there. To whom? No. To whom did he write this letter? It's often suggested, since it's addressed to the Hebrews, that it must be sent to the church in Jerusalem. They're Hebrews. And they have the temple. They have the temple there in Jerusalem, and the letter talks a lot about the sacrifices of the Old Testament religion. Would indicate, perhaps, that his audience was the Jerusalem church. But, and I have points A through E, five, I guess. who his audience was. A, it is written in Greek. It's written in Greek. That's obvious. That's kind of it's so obvious, it's overlooked. You know, having studied at the feet of Gamaliel in Jerusalem, the Apostle Paul was fluent in Hebrew. If he wanted to write to the Jerusalem church, he certainly could have written in the language of Jesus Christ himself, Aramaic or Hebrew, but he did not. Instead, he writes in Greek, and that is because he is writing to the Jewish Christians of his own churches in Asia Minor and in Greece. And not just ordinary Greek, as I just explained. He writes in a high academic style of Greek, Alexandrian Greek it's called, some people would call it. He is addressing people who are familiar with that kind of academic language and who are impressed by it. Who would that be? Wouldn't be the Jews of Jerusalem. But the Jewish Christians of his own churches in Asia Minor and in Greece. B, as I already pointed out, Paul and Timothy had labored together with these people that he's writing to. He calls, as I just read, he calls Timothy his beloved brother. He is writing to his own churches who would regard Timothy as their brother. C, Hebrews 6 and verse 10. Hebrews 6 and verse 10. God is not unrighteous to forget your work and your labor of love, which you have showed toward his name in that you have ministered to the saints. You have served the church and do minister. This is an obvious, I think it's obvious, a reference to the offering that Paul collected among his own churches to send to the Jerusalem church. He is addressing this letter to the people who sent it, which is the Greek Asia Minor churches. Hebrews 10, this is point D, the fourth evidence to me of who he's writing to. Hebrews 10, verse 32. Call to remembrance the former days in which you were illuminated. You endured a great fight of afflictions. Whoever he's writing to were persecuted, partly while you were made a gazing stock, both by the reproaches and afflictions, and partly while you became companions of them that were so used. For you had compassion of me. Who was he's writing to? People who had compassion of Paul himself while he was in bonds and took joyfully the spoiling of your goods. Paul's churches had suffered persecution and they had supported him. The church in Jerusalem had not been persecuted. True, they had killed James and they had imprisoned Peter, but they had not persecuted the rest of the church. And chapter 12, verse 4 adds that you have not yet resisted to blood. There had been martyrs in Jerusalem, but there had not been martyrs in Paul's churches. That's another indication of who he's writing to. And E, Hebrews 13, verse 9. He asked for their prayers, saying, that I may be restored to you the sooner. Who's he returning to? His own churches. These are the internal evidences of the letter itself that exactly fit Paul's history with his churches, his congregations of the church. The Jews of Asia Minor, Macedonia, Achaia, and no other writer, no other place. Okay, that's my premise, that this is Paul's epistle, that he is writing to his own churches. But my main point is today, why? Why is he writing this letter? It's quite apparent when you read Hebrews that Paul is exhorting his churches to remain faithful to the faith as he has taught them. Hebrews 5 and verse 12 says, For the time you ought to be teachers, you Jews, who've known the scriptures all your lives, you have a need that one teach you again, which be the first principles of the oracles of God. The question is, what are they in danger of believing instead? They've been taught the scriptures all their life. They've had Paul preach the gospel to them. What is it that somebody is leading them to believe instead? So we go to the text now from the beginning of Hebrews, starting in chapter 1. And what is he arguing here? What is the problem? Who's creating the issue? He gets into the idea pretty quickly here. Verse 1. God, who at sundry times and diverse manners spoke in time past unto the fathers by the prophets, has in these last days spoken unto us by his Son, whom he has appointed heir of all things, by whom also he made the world. This is Christ supreme, the Son of God. Verse 4, skipping to 4, that is Christ being made so much better than the angels, as he has by inheritance obtained a more excellent name than they, more excellent than the angels. I think it's a rather strange, out-of-place issue for Paul to be raising this question right up front. Who would have a mistaken view of the importance of angels? Why would that be an issue if he were writing to the Christian Jews of Judea? But in fact, it is a big issue because he's going to spend two chapters on that issue, the very first two chapters of Hebrews, that Christ is superior to the angels. So point number one of my 3 points here, it's angels, Melchizedek, and the tabernacle. Number one, the problem with angels, chapters 1 through 3. Who's raising this problem with the angels? Skipping to chapter 2, verse 5. For unto the angels he has not put in subjection the world to come. Maybe somebody's suggesting that he had put the world to come under the angels. Verse 16, just kind of skipping to the high points here. For verily he took not on him the nature of angels, that is Christ was not like an angel, but he took on him the seed of Abraham. Which is so important. Angels were a primary concern not to Judaism. In fact, the caretakers of the temple in Jerusalem were the Sadducees. They didn't even believe in angels, did they? It is a primary concern, however, of the Gnostic philosophy. And we have seen Paul fight it earlier in his epistles. I'll just take just in snatches, little snatches earlier in the epistles of Paul. Let's detour for a moment to a few examples. Well, I have in my notes. I won't take the time to turn to them. 1 Corinthians 13:1. This is the love chapter, the importance of love. But remember, Paul says there to the Corinthians, though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not charity, I am become as a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. Speaking in tongues was a major spiritual controversy in Corinth. I think it's noteworthy here that love is held up to be more important than the tongues of angels, because the opponents wanted to speak in the tongues of angels. Another snippet is from Romans 8:38, Paul says, I am persuaded that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor powers. And I've gone through this before. Principalities and powers is a Gnostic terminology. And he puts angels right in that list. Nor things present, nor things to come. I have contended that Romans was written to head off the underpinnings of the Gnostic philosophy. And one of their superstitions, or some of their superstitions, were about powers and principalities that apparently had, or in their philosophy, had power or influence over us. So apparently they thought that they had superstitions about the influence of angels. He includes angels in that list, that angels also have influence over us. Paul's fighting this. In Galatians 1, verse 8, he's obviously fighting a terrific outbreak of heresy in Galatia when he writes to them, but though we or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel unto you than that which you have than that which we have preached to you, let him be accursed." Where does the true gospel come from? Paul says Jesus Christ preached the true gospel to him. None other gospel is to be believed, even if it is claimed that it was preached by angels. Angels are a problem. Or at least their belief, not the angels aren't a problem, but the belief about angels and their influence is a problem. Colossians 2:18. Last one here, my aside here, to examples of this conflict about the subject of angels that Paul has fought all through his epistles up to this point, up to the epistle to the Hebrews. Colossians 2:18. "Let no man beguile you of your reward in a voluntary humility and worshiping of angels." The Colossians were being beguiled by what is in the Greek literally just worship angels. It doesn't say worshiping of angels. Literally, it's worship angels. It could be worshiping angels themselves. I doubt it. I think it is worshiping as the angels or doing angel worship. That is, worshiping like the angels worship. Where they worship, how they worship. A spiritual experience, worshiping with the angels, perhaps speaking in tongues of angels. But it's not true. Paul says that's not true. They are being beguiled into seeking that spiritual experience. They're seeking it through ceremony and ritual and other kinds of works, which he says are not true. Thus, the first two chapters. Just read it in that context sometime. The whole two chapters are proving that Christ is superior to the angels. Why bother? Because it was a major issue to put forth by the opposition. This is the first big indication of who his opposition was and why he wrote the letter to the Hebrews. The next two chapters, chapters 3 and 4, I'll just summarize as the need for faithfulness. There's nothing here that is particularly evidence that he's arguing against a heresy. But the argument that he's making here is central to his purpose of this letter, that they are to be remain faithful to the gospel as he preached it. And that is completely consistent with fighting the heresy. The root of the Gnostic heresy, as I've said before, seems to be the belief that the God of the Old Testament is not faithful. He's not faithful. Remember, Romans is written to show that God is faithful. These people believe that the God of the Old Testament was not faithful. That God had promised Israel to be a great nation. And instead, look, they were a backwater ruled by Gentile empires. God had not delivered on his promises. Therefore, the God of the Old Testament could not be relied upon. And we look for a higher God, a God that the God of the Old Testament was ignorant of. This was a Jewish philosophy. It was based upon the Bible with a great deal of Hellenistic influence. But it was a Jewish philosophy that was essentially anti-Judaism. Jewish anti-Judaism. That's what we call it. So I think chapters 3 and 4, Paul is arguing, no, Jesus Christ confirms and fulfills the Old Testament. We don't look for a higher God. He proves that Jesus Christ is even more faithful than Moses. In Hebrews 3, verse 2, he says, "Who was faithful to him that appointed him, as also Moses was faithful." In fact, he proves that Christ as the Son is more faithful than Moses. And so Christ is our example of faithfulness. In chapter 3, he goes into the example of Israel. Take heed, this is 3 verse 12. "Take heed, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief, departing from the living God, as Israel departed and did not obey on the edge of the promised land." And then he goes into chapter 4 saying that promise that they missed out on is still ahead of us. Chapter 4 says in verse 9, there remains therefore a rest to the people of God. That promise is yet to be fulfilled. Verse 11 in chapter 4 says, let us labor therefore to enter that rest, lest any man fall after the same example of unbelief. We do labor. We labor to enter the kingdom. And your labor is not works of law. It is not ceremony or ritual or form without substance. But we labor in obedience, as Paul would call it, steadfast to the end. And these two chapters are consistent, I think, with the same basic argument that he made in Romans, that God is indeed faithful, that he is working out that single plan that he's had since creation that he promised to Abraham. And he concludes this argument in chapter 4, verse 14. Seeing then that you have a great high priest that has passed into the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast. That's his point of this letter. Hold fast this gospel. But this mention of Jesus as the high priest leads to the next point of clarification that he has to make against the heresy that he's fighting. So number two, is Christ as high priest, chapters 5 through 7. Christ as high priest, or you could say, put it in one word, Melchizedek. Christ as the high priest after the order of Melchizedek. It goes on for three chapters here with this subject. He begins in chapter 5 by explaining how Christ is indeed a high priest. Even though he's not a Levite, he's not of the family of Aaron, he's still a high priest. Verse 10, called of God and high priest after the order of Melchizedek. Verse 11, of whom we have many things to say, this strange being, I think, called Melchizedek, and hard to be uttered, seeing you are dull of hearing. Now, he's quoting from Psalm 110, as he does six times in this letter. Very pivotal to this argument, Psalms 110. He chides his readers that they ought to know the first principles of the Old Testament, but that they have lost their bearings, and they've been misled over the subject of the high priest. And in chapter 6, he goes on to the things that they should have remembered about the Old Testament. And I think he's going into this because they've been misled on the meanings of the Old Testament. He reminds them of Abraham and his patience. In other words, the Jewish Christians of Paul's churches in Asia Minor and Greece need to persist in the gospel as Paul taught it to them, after the example of Jesus Christ, who is the high priest after the order of Melchizedek. Now, it's a little striking to me that Paul has to do a long explanation in three chapters here of this person, Melchizedek. This is a little-known person from the Old Testament. In all the Old Testament, how many times does Melchizedek appear? His name appears twice, just twice, in the entire Old Testament. Genesis 14, when Abraham brought tithes to him, and again in Psalm 110, where David prophesies that the Messiah will be a priest after the order of Melchizedek. Paul talks about Melchizedek seven times in these three chapters. Why? Why this fixation on this person, Melchizedek? Well, Melchizedek is exalted in a book called 2 Enoch, which is a sectarian Jewish work that was contemporary with Paul's writings. Jewish sects and philosophers of that time were apparently speculating on the true spiritual priesthood. They were really hung up on a spiritual priesthood. An example would be the Essenes. Josephus writes about the Essenes of Judea. They were greatly obsessed with a spiritual priesthood. And there is a document named Melchizedek that was discovered in the Gnostic texts, discovered in Egypt at Nag Hammadi. In it, Melchizedek is plainly interpreted by this philosophy as one of the bringers of true spiritual knowledge. He's a Christ figure. Before Christianity, Jewish Gnosticism postulated light bringers in the persons of Seth, son of Adam, particularly, and Melchizedek. In their document, they sing praises to Melchizedek along with the eons, or the emanations of God, the unknown God, you know, the Gnostic God. They say things like this, quote, "They said to me, 'Be strong, O Melchizedek, high priest of the God Most High, for the archons, who are your enemies, made war, but you have prevailed over them.'" And so I think Paul has to clarify and put Christ in the role of the high priest, not some mystical fulfillment of David's prophecy. In chapter 7, for example, Paul describes Melchizedek as not merely a man, but probably, and I think is Paul's conclusion here, but Paul says this is hard to understand, maybe I'm dull of hearing, but I think he's concluding that Jesus Christ, before his human birth, was Melchizedek. Melchizedek was obviously more than a man. He explains in chapter 7 how Jesus, being a Jew, could be a priest. Verse 11. "If their perfection were by the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law," that is the ceremonial law, "what further need was there that another priest should arise after the order of Melchizedek and not be called after the order of Aaron?" How could Christ as a Jew be a priest? Verse 12, "For the priesthood being changed, there is made of necessity a change also of the law," the ceremonial law. A change in the law about the priesthood and a change in its priestly duties. Verse 24, "But this man, Jesus Christ, because he continues ever, forever, has an unchangeable priesthood." Verse 26, "For such a high priest became us who is holy, harmless, undefiled, separate from sinners, made higher than the heavens." And thus Jesus Christ, Paul is arguing here, is the old, was the Old Testament Melchizedek, and now he resumes that office as the new high priest. And all this to counter the Gnostic philosophy and other mystical Jewish ideas about a heavenly priesthood. So I think this section, 5 through 7, is the second big indication of who Paul is writing this letter to. Paul is confronting the heresy and their ideas of the priesthood. Lastly, is the issue of the priestly service that are done according to the Old Testament ritual. And this would be, then number 3, is the true tabernacle. The tabernacles. I said there are 3 points here. Angels, Melchizedek, and the tabernacle. The true tabernacle is described in chapters 8 through 10. Chapter 8. "Now, the things which we have spoken, of the things which we have spoken, this is the sum. We have such an high priest who is set on the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens, a minister of the sanctuary of the true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched, and not man." Paul would be agreeing here that there is a heavenly tabernacle, and that Christ is the high priest of that heavenly tabernacle. But I think the big thing to notice here in the argument that follows here in these 3 chapters is that the issue is not the temple. There is no mention of a temple in Hebrews. The issue is the tabernacle. Those are 2 different Greek words. Lots of places the temple is talked about in the New Testament. 2 different Greek words. This is the tabernacle. Paul refers to the tabernacle 9 times in chapters 8, 9, and 13, but he never, ever mentions the temple. I'd agree with a commentator, B.H. Carroll, who observes that if the Hebrews were addressed, that is, if this letter to the Hebrews were addressed to the Palestinian Jews, then the absence of any reference to the temple, the Herodian temple, would be inexplicable. But he does not mention the temple. But the Jewish zeal for the temple, which was raging soon after this letter was written in Judea, is not the issue here. The audience is not Judea. The audience is in Asia Minor and Greece. And the issue is a heavenly tabernacle and an attempt to worship in it with the angels, like the angels worship. You know, to the heretics, I think that the Old Testament law was like a secret code. Everything was interpreted metaphorically. Nothing could be read straightforward. It all had to be interpreted as a metaphor. But the Old Testament rituals, therefore, of the tabernacle that are dictated in the law are metaphors to them of how to worship in this spiritual tabernacle. Now, Paul would agree with them that the tabernacle is a pattern of something higher in reality. Note chapter 8, verse 4. Breaking in here, he says, there already exist priests. There are priests that offer gifts according to the law. But verse 5, who serve unto the example and shadow of heavenly things, as Moses was admonished of God when he was about to make the tabernacle, that is the tent, whose pattern that God gave in great detail to Moses. See, he said that you make all things according to the pattern shown you in the mount, because God dictated those details. Paul is going to argue that the Old Testament religion, however, of that tabernacle were ineffective. That is, the ritual religion did not change anybody's heart or mind. And he will argue that the ineffectiveness of the ritual law was the reason that it was abolished and it was completely replaced by the sacrifice of Christ once for all. But the heretics on the other side would make something quite different out of the rituals of the tabernacle. An example would be from the first century. First century Jewish view of the heavenly tabernacle is a work called The Song of the Sabbath Sacrifice. You can find it on the web. You can go to gnosis.org. It's not a Gnostic document. It's a Jewish document, but it's from the first century. Gnosis.org says this of it: the Songs of the Sabbath Sacrifice, also known as the Angelic Liturgy, is a liturgical work composed of 13 separate sections, one for each of the first 13 Sabbaths of the year. The songs evoke angelic praise and elaborate on angelic priesthood, the heavenly tabernacle, the heavenly temple, as they say in Gnosis.org, and the Sabbath worship in that temple. It's an ancient parchment that's not, as I said, not a Gnostic text, it's a Jewish text. But it's contemporary with Paul. Here's a snippet from that ancient text. It says, sing with joy, you who rejoice in his knowledge, with rejoicing among the wondrous godlike beings, worshiping with the angels, with the wondrous godlike beings, and chant his glory with the tongue, speaking in tongues, the tongues of angels, chant his glory with the tongue of all who chant with knowledge, and chant his wonderful songs of joy. I point this out as an example of Jewish speculations. The Jews, especially the philosophers amongst the Jews at that time, were full of all kinds of speculations. And Gnosticism grew out of Jewish speculations. The heresy seemed to be that one could rise above the typical human ignorance of the true God by understanding the hidden message, the hidden messages of the ritual law. On the one hand, it's kind of a contradiction. One hand, the God of the Old Testament, they thought, was not the highest God, but only suppressed the knowledge of the true God. And on the other hand, they thought that hints about the true God could be found in the ritual law, if you interpreted it metaphorically. You could rise to new heights of spirituality by means of rituals and understanding of the ritual law. And against this, Paul is arguing that the rituals were only there to point us to the sacrifice of Christ. Otherwise, the ritual law is obsolete. And instead, the important thing is a spirit of faithfulness, which is his point of this whole letter, that they are to remain faithful to the gospel. Hebrews 8, verse 10. For this is the covenant that I will make with them. I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says the Lord. I will put my laws into their mind and write them in their hearts, and I will be to them a God, and they shall be to me a people. And in chapter 9, he goes on with the true purpose of the tabernacle and its rituals. Chapter 9, verse 2. For there was a tabernacle made, the first, wherein was the candlestick and the table and the showbread, verse 9, which was a figure for the time then present, in which were offered gifts and sacrifices that could not make him that did the service perfect as pertaining to the conscience. It did not give God's Spirit. It was ineffective. But verse 11, but Christ, being come an high priest of good things to come by a greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is to say, not of this building, just as the heretics sought. They sought a spiritual tabernacle, but Christ is the high priest, Paul is saying, over the spiritual tabernacle, not the angels. Verse 12, neither by the blood of goats and calves, but by his own blood he entered in once into the holy place, having obtained eternal redemption for us. So Paul is combating the Gnostic denial of Christ being human and dying on the cross, dying on the stake, dying by shedding his blood. Christ, Paul is saying, is the high priest because he offers his own blood, which is completely contradictory to the Gnostic heresy. And in chapter 10, he continues his explanation of the tabernacle. 10:1. For the law, that is the ritual law, that is the law of the service in the tabernacle, having a shadow of good things to come and not the very image of those things, can never, with those sacrifices which they offer year by year continually, make the comers thereunto perfect or complete. Can't change their heart or mind, for it's not possible that the blood of bulls and goats should take away sins. By the way, I don't think he's saying that God could not forgive sin, or that God did not forgive sin in the Old Testament, that he did. God assured them that he would, but the rituals had no effect on their hearts. Only the addition of God's Spirit could make the worshipers perfect or complete. Verse 6, in burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin, you have no pleasure. They're done away. Verse 7, then said I, Jesus Christ, I come, in the volume of the book it is written of me, to do your will, O God. I come to do your will. That is the whole attitude that we're to learn from Christ, isn't it? It is that Spirit which creates the perfect example of obedience in Jesus Christ. And he comes to the point in this argument in verse 21, and having an high priest over the house of God, Jesus Christ, let us hold fast the profession of our faith, as Paul has taught them, without wavering, for he is faithful that promised. God is faithful, contrary to this Gnostic heretical speculation. Let the Jewish Christians of Paul's churches hold fast the gospel that he preached to them. This is Paul's battle plan here in the book of Hebrews against the heresy that is leading his churches astray. Now, this is only a brief summary. Hebrews is a long book, a lot in it, but I wanted to bring out the heresy of the day and how it shaped, I think, this letter. The fight against these ideas runs through the entire New Testament. And in Hebrews, we see Paul being forced to confront those issues that were particularly influential to the Jewish Christians of his churches. The ideas of mystically approaching or knowing personally God. So I think we've seen here three very distinctive arguments in Hebrews. One, again, the angels and how Christ is superior to them. Two, Melchizedek. Not some fantastic speculations about an ancient Christ-like person, but how Christ himself is the prophesied high priest after the order of Melchizedek. And three, the purpose of the Old Testament tabernacle and how that purpose has been fulfilled It's the same purpose that's been from the beginning. It's not to be imitated. That is, the rituals of the Old Testament tabernacle are not to be imitated in some spiritualized heavenly tabernacle. These are all indications, I think, of the heresy troubling the Jews of Paul's churches. And why know this? I think knowing the heresy, I believe, helps us understand some of Paul's statements that are hard to understand.